Hello, everybody. Welcome to the latest and greatest episode of Inside the Hexagon. I am your host, as always, Phil Lanides, and alongside me is my co-host, Josh Molina. Josh?
I'm doing great. I'm really looking forward to this card. I was actually a little bit surprised. It didn't feel like a Strikeforce show, but it felt like it was a pretty decent, good, entertaining MMA card. I guess when you have low expectations, that happens. But I'm excited to talk about this.
You're definitely the more pessimistic of the two. And I think it's probably the fact that you're a journalist by trade, and by trade I'm a publicist, so I'm supposed to be positive and pump things up, and you're supposed to be, you know, not negative, but more critical, you know? So I guess that it's probably why we make a good kind of yin and yang on all this. So
yeah, I always tell people that journalists are supposed to write about when systems don't work, when they don't function the way they should. If we wrote about how everything works, well, it's supposed to work, right? Like, we're supposed to write about when things don't work.
And if you wrote about things that worked, nobody would read it, because if it bleeds, it leads. And we all know that. People they don't like bad news, but they're drawn to bad news, and that's just how it is. But yeah. I agree with you. That's actually, it's very well put. This was, my thought was at the end of the show is that it didn't seem, it pretty much, you put it in to words what I was thinking, is that it's not really like a Strikeforce show. There's not a whole lot of Strikeforce regulars on this. So it's really more of just a good MMA card, like you said. But let's welcome our listeners. Inside the Hexagon is about walking through the major events, fighters, and milestones of Strikeforce, which was a very important and innovative MMA promotion that existed from 2006 until 2013. And on today's episode, we will be discussing Strikeforce Payback, which featured the only Strikeforce fights in the careers of Frank Trigg and the karate hottie Michelle Watterson. And in the main event, Dwayne Bang Ludwig took on Sammy Morgan in a rematch, and it's going to be a good one. So I'm looking forward to diving into this. So if you're ready, Josh, let's go ahead and dive in.
Yeah, let's go in and just dive in.
All right, sounds good. So we want to, of course, go through the fallout from the previous Strikeforce event, which was the final Playboy Mansion show. It was really more of a one-off event, didn't really advance Strikeforce as a promotion. Pride veterans Kazuo Misaki and Mitsuhiro Ishida made their promotional debuts, and they both got wins, though Misaki's was a controversial stoppage that you and I argued back and forth over, in which he beat Joe Diesel Riggs. UFC veteran Terry Martin made his Strikeforce debut as well, and he stopped Corey DeVella with a pretty vicious left hand. And then Trevor Prangley got his second Strikeforce win against Anthony Ruiz in a rematch of their previous bout, which Prangley had also won. And quick plug, our episode last week, if you missed it, was a discussion with Trevor Prangley, so definitely go back into the archives and check that out. In addition, Strikeforce lightweight champ Josh Thompson got a 9 title win against an overmatched Ash Bowman. The natural next step was, of course, a title defense, a rematch against Gilbert Melendez. However, due to injuries, that would be postponed and would not happen for 14 months. All right, in August of 2008, Payback was announced to take place on October 3rd at the Broomfield Event Center in Broomfield, Colorado. The event would feature Frank Trigg versus Strikeforce veteran Falonico Vitale. In the main event, two Strikeforce vets would return as Dwayne Bang Ludwig would take on Sammy Morgan, which was a rematch. Morgan had won their first fight via KO in front of a local Denver crowd a few years prior. Also announced for the card were Phil Baroni and Pete Spratt, both UFC veterans. Later, a scrap between K1 veterans Pat Barry and Andre Walker would be added. Walker had 5 MMA fights while Barry would be making his MMA debut. However, Barry would end up accepting an offer from the UFC and would be replaced by AKA fighter Carlos Avalos, a New York State Metro boxing champion who was making his MMA debut. Let me stop right there real quick. Do you remember Pat Barry, Josh?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, he was definitely a favorite of mine. I really, yeah, really enjoyed Pat as a fighter. Just, he was so honest. I mean, he'd come, you know, after a fight, whether it was a win or loss, he'd be like, yeah, I sucked, or, uh-huh, you know, I did, uh-huh, good. And he was just so, I mean, the guy had personality for days. I mean, charisma for days. I really think he could have done great in wrestling, in my opinion. I really liked him. I got to, obviously, he was trained by Duke Rufus, and so I got to have a little bit of contact with him, and just such a great guy. I really, really like him, and he is the boyfriend, or I don't think they're married, but the boyfriend of Rose Namajunas, the former UFC strawweight champion, if I remember correctly.
But so you think he could have been the original Matt Riddle? Is that what you meant by wrestling?
I mean, see, part of Matt's thing is that he was really successful in MMA, and I don't, you know, Pat was not. He was great in kickboxing, so I think it would have been a little tougher on Pat, because He didn't have a great run in the UFC. He was just, you know, very colorful and entertaining. But I mean, he's got the charisma for it. I think he could still do it if he really wanted to. But
yeah.
But anyways, but Phil Baroni was also scheduled to fight, as we mentioned. That would not end up happening. I'm not sure why he was pulled from the card. Pete Spratt would end up taking on Donnie Lyles, while rising lightweight star Billy Evangelista would battle UFC veteran Luke Quadillo. In addition, the karate hottie Michelle Waterson would take on Tyra Parker. Also, the event would air on HDNet, the second Strikeforce event to do so. And I wanted to mention, as I was doing my research, that there was an interview Damon Martin did with Gilbert Melendez for MMA Weekly. Melendez said that he had one fight left on his contract with Strikeforce, and then he said he was, I mean, nice things to say about Strikeforce, but he said he was planning to fight out his deal and then test the free agency waters. And there was a big chance he'd be, and that was a quote from him, a big chance that he'd be heading to the UFC, which would have been a huge loss for Strikeforce. That did not end up happening for whatever reason, as Gil would end up re-signing, and eventually he would get his title rematch against Josh the Punk Thompson. All right, as we like to do, we like to let you know what was going on in the UFC around this time. The UFC champions at the time of this event, BJ Penn was the lightweight champion, GSP, the undisputed welterweight champion, Anderson Silva, the reigning middleweight champ, Forrest Griffin, the UFC light heavyweight champ, and the UFC heavyweight division was still in flux. Minotauro Nogueira was the interim heavyweight champion, but Randy Couture still officially had the heavyweight strap, and that would change in short order, and we'll talk about that soon. But the closest major UFC event to the Strikeforce event that we're talking about today, UFC 89 took place on October 18, 2008 at the National Indoor Arena in Birmingham, England, in front of a crowd of 9,515 fans. Pretty memorable bout that we saw there was future UFC interim heavyweight champion Shane Carwin dispatching Neil Wayne via TKO in short order, earning his second promotional victory. The Irish Hand Grenade, another one of my favorite MMA nicknames, Marcus Davis and Chris Lights Out Lytle both took home wins, as did the Dean of Mean, Keith Jardine. And in the main event, Michael Bisping beat the crippler Chris Lieben by decision in front of his hometown crowd. Of note, Lieben would test positive for Stanozolol, there we go, after the fight and be fined and suspended.
Is that a steroid?
Yes, that is a steroid, correct.
I would not really ever think Chris Lieben was on steroids. But
yeah, I mean, and he, I read, he said afterwards that he'd taken it like months before and he thought it would be out of his system by then. I don't know if that's cycling on and off, but Lieben was never a body guy. So, but he did always, he, you know, was always carrying injuries, and steroids help you recover from injuries. So
right.
That would be my guess versus trying to look like a bodybuilder.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. There was no Strikeforce Challengers event around this event, so nothing to discuss there. So we can jump right into the event details. Strikeforce Payback took place on October 3rd, 2008 at the Broomfield Event Center in Broomfield, Colorado. The event, according to Wikipedia, as we discussed on our last event episode, which is always 100% accurate, would end up drawing 3,286 fans. I could not find any substantiation for that, but that makes sense. The center ran, I think it was between 6,500 and 7,500, depending on the event, was capacity. So that again, that makes sense. This was once again broadcast on HDNet. Commentary duties would be handled by Kenny Rice and Matt Hume, with Ron Kruk handling post-fight interviews. And for the listeners that aren't aware, Matt Hume, he's been involved in MMA for many, many years. He was a fighter for a while. He took on guys as tough as Ken Shamrock, Minoru Suzuki, and Pat Miletich. In fact, he beat Miletich. I think he broke his nose. But he really made his mark as a trainer in MMA. He's trained the likes of, and still does train, Demetrius Johnson, Bibiano Fernandez, and then he's also trained guys like Josh Barnett, the aforementioned Chris Lieben, Rich Franklin, many, many others. So very, very, very well-known, very respected fighter trainer, and just somebody to remember. Later on, after his fight career, he was the rule director and official trainer for both Pride Fighting Championships and Dream, and he is now the VP of operations for ONE FC. So he's still very much involved in the sport of MMA. But let's jump into the undercard. This was interesting. This was the first Strikeforce event that I can remember that featured amateur bouts. I can't remember us covering any other events that have featured amateur bouts up to this point. So kind of interesting there. So we're going to burn through those pretty quickly. None of the guys that we're going to discuss ended up fighting for Strikeforce again or you know, really having much of a pro career. So we're just going to quickly move through these. 125-pound bout, which I believe was the first male 125-pound bout in Strikeforce history. Aaron Trujillo defeated Haven Torres via TKO, coming by way of punches at 259 of the first round. In a catchweight 140-pound fight, Terrell Galloway defeated Brett Tillis via submission, coming by way of rear naked choke at 121 of the first round. In a lightweight bout, again, amateur Eric Galvan defeated Jeremy Malateri via split decision. And then in a another 155-pound amateur bout, Alan Gomez defeated Jordan Goodwin via unanimous decision. All right, so let's start jumping into the fights that we're actually going to really delve into. This was the last amateur bout on the card. Drew Dober defeated Lumumba Sayers via KO, coming by way of a punch at 18 seconds of the first round. These are two names that might be familiar to you. Sayers would have a run in Strikeforce as a pro, while Dober would also compete in Bellator and the UFC. Dober was 5-0 as an amateur coming into this one, while this was Sayers' debut. And I did want to mention, Sayers actually came in a bit heavy for this fight. They were given some additional time, but was not able to get under 171 pounds. Dober opted to still take the fight. I mean, he was like 171.2 or 0.6 or something like that. So, I mean, he was close. And Sayers wasn't fine since this was an amateur bout, so there was no pay involved. I could not find any video of this fight, but obviously very quick one. It was a punch in 18 seconds, so, you know, obviously pretty quick. Dober would be one and done with Strikeforce, but he would be part of season 15 of The Ultimate Fighter before joining the UFC full-time in 2013. And he is, as we record this in December of 2020, he is still with the promotion. He's gone 9-5-1 with victories over guys like Jamie Varner, Josh Berkman, and others. So very successful career for Dober. And again, Sayers would return to Strikeforce as a pro. It would be in 2011, so we will be discussing him more in future episodes.
What do you think, Phil? Can you go 18 seconds with Drew Dober? Do you think you could have outlasted
that? I think I could. I think I could run around for 20 seconds. I think I could do that. It's a, you know, cage is like 20 by 20, right? So I think I could handle that. It's bigger than 20. I'm thinking of pro wrestling rings. I don't know how big the hexagon was. That's a good question, but that I just asked myself. But yeah, I think I could run around for 20 seconds. All right.
I've always imagined how long I could last with John Jones. Like, would it be 5 seconds, 10 seconds, 20?
He put your lights out whenever he felt like it. I mean,
that's what I mean. But like, you know, could I, you know, dance and, you know, force it to go 30 seconds, you know?
Maybe.
I mean, I picked John Jones because, I mean, this guy, you know, has defeated every fighter among the greatest fighters that are on the planet. So, you know, what would he do to, you know, just an average dad, you know?
Yeah.
It's crazy, but I don't know. And let me ask you this. Would you rather fight Mike Tyson or John Jones?
I'm more scared of Mike Tyson. I'll tell you that.
Isn't that crazy?
Like, I'm more scared of Mike Tyson because I just feel like he could just kill me. Like, Jones is so cerebral. I think he would know. Like, Tyson just seems, and I know he's chilled out in recent years and all that stuff, but it's Tyson. I definitely would be. I think Jones would have would finish me quicker, but and he'd have more options. But yeah, Tyson. I'm more scared of Tyson for sure.
Can't you like do a little, you know, take Tyson down?
Yeah, I guess. And I feel like I've got a little bit of wrestling. I feel like I might have a chance to kind of get a waist lock and, you know, maybe German him or something like that. I don't know. I mean, but I'm still more scared of him. I wouldn't even want to grab onto him. I just feel like his fury would just radiate through my body and I would just explode or something.
And you'd lose an ear. Yeah.
All right. Well, in our next bout, 145 pounds, Tyler Toner defeated Ricky Johnson via TKO, coming by way of punches at 344 of the second round. This is the first fight that we actually had video for. But whoever put this fight together should not have. I mean, you put a 7-1 guy against an 0-1 guy. I mean, it was just huge mismatch on paper. Toner just so much more experienced than Ricky Johnson, and it showed in the fight. I mean, Johnson had his moments early on, but Toner was clearly the more poised and experienced fighter here. He bloodied Ricky's nose in the first, and it was mostly downhill after that. Johnson got a couple nice strikes early in the second round, but Toner's experience advantage was just so apparent throughout, and he finished the fight later on in the round. And I know you have some thoughts on this, but I wanted to mention, this is one of those things where I think as a fighter, you have to have fights in order to learn to weather the storm. Like, when you get hurt and you're early on in your career, it's like, I think it was, speaking of Tyson, I think he's the one that said everybody's got a plan until they get hit in the mouth. Yeah. And, you know, when Ricky Johnson got hit and got hurt, you could just kind of see the panic. He didn't have his composure anymore. And I think as the more experience you get as a fighter, the more you learn to deal with that and still at least look composed and at least look poised and all that. So this was a pretty big mismatch, but yeah, what did you think, Josh?
Well, I'm, from an entertainment perspective, I thought it was a good fight, not in the sense of a competitive
from,
fight.
From a Gladiator, the movie, are you not entertained perspective, sure.
Yeah, I mean, I saw the Crimson Mask, I saw the blood. I mean, it was like a spectacle. So it was entertaining. It had a very pro wrestling feel because this guy was bleeding a lot. It was like, oh my goodness. And he was definitely a bleeder. I mean, it's another thing too is... you know, some guy.
What was the we've got a bleeder? something about Mary. Yeah. Anyway, sorry. Go ahead.
So, well, there's something about that too. Like you get cut easier if you've never been, you know, cut before. It's just like you build up a certain amount of grit that you have, both physically as well as emotionally and mentally. And you're right in this sense. You saw him like almost panicked in his eyes while he was getting trounced and beat up. I did like Toner's Muay Thai. That was very impressive. He clearly has developed that skill. He was doing lots of clenching and, you know, the knees, and he was in control. I thought that was a really good display of his Muay Thai skills. And I thought that it went a little long. I know I'm always complaining about these fights getting stopped too early, but I felt like this guy was getting beaten, and there was blood everywhere, and the referee kind of let it go a little bit longer, like it was a championship fight or something, like this guy had a champion's advantage. But he hung in there, did the best he could, and by the end, it was just, you just can't beat that. So I thought it was entertaining.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, maybe the ref could have stopped it and had the doc look at the cut or something to at least buy some time and see if he wanted to stop the fight. So I agree with you there. But neither fighter would fight for Strikeforce again. Both would go on, however, to have respectable careers. Toner would be on The Ultimate Fighter season 12, and he stopped fighting in 2014 with a 15-7 record. Johnson also last fought in 2014. He ended up with a 10-6 record. So they both ended up with again respectable careers. All right, in what was the feature bout of the undercard, Michelle Waterson defeated Tyra Parker via submission, coming by way of rear naked choke at 120 of the first round. Strikeforce was obviously trying to build up Michelle Waterson for this. She was, you know, she's from Colorado, so she's a native there, so that was, I'm sure, part of it. They even put out a press release kind of story on her. They got picked up by various websites. Josh, I wanted to read the opening paragraph to you because it just shows you, this is 2008, and it just shows you how much times have changed. Quote, quote, to the naked eye, Michelle, which, I mean, naked eye, like it almost like you had to use
that. That was intentional too,
yes,
that word.
Yeah. I think. Quote, to the naked eye, Michelle Waterson looks more like she should be gracing the pages of Maxim rather than beating up on opponents in caged combat. Just like the old cliche, looks can be deceiving goes, though, it turns out that the petite 22-year-old, otherwise known as the karate hottie, packs as much firepower as she does gorgeous looks. Yeah, don't see that flying in today's world, in today's MMA. I just don't see that. I mean, but that just stood out to me so much. I felt like I had to read that to our listeners.
You know, I'm like super offended. If I could shoot here and be real, I mean, that's totally out of line. I mean, that's the kind of language you really only reserve for someone like Luke Rockhold.
I knew there was something coming.
Yeah, no. If I could just interrupt you for a second, like obviously it was the style of the times. A lot of MMA writers didn't really know how to write about women, and they were learning, and it was awkward. And obviously you would never write about a man that way. You should not write about a woman that way. These are athletes. She did have a little bit of a history, obviously, being a model. So you could make a case that, you know, she's transitioning from that to this. But I think that, you know, people like Ronda Rousey, you know, they really changed that. But, you know, I think it's we've come a long way, thankfully. And it's one of Strikeforce's legacies, quite honestly. They gave women an opportunity on a big stage at a time when Dana White wouldn't do it, and showcase them. And at some point, women's MMA, thanks to Ronda and obviously the women who followed her, it became main event status. So You know, you got to start somewhere. But yeah, I did. That language is hilarious. You know,
would not fly today. And all, I mean, also Gina Carano, Chris Cyborg, Marlo's Conan. I mean, the women that even had established themselves before Ronda. And, you know, I mean, this is Michelle Waterson, who's still a part of the UFC now. So there, you know, she's got to be mentioned in there as, you know, not somebody that was built on, but somebody that was part of, you know, that movement, you know, the evolution, so to speak.
Do they still call her the Karate Hottie?
I don't know. I really don't know. I don't follow today's MMA as closely. So I've never seen her fight other than this fight, to be honest with you. So I don't know. I know I've seen that around, and I want to say that her, like, her Instagram handle is something along those lines. In fact, let me check that. Karate Hottie. Yeah. At Karate Hottie MMA. That's her Instagram handle. So she owns it, you know, so it's nothing she shies away from even now.
But, yeah, I mean, and if she calls herself, that's one thing, but, you know, gorgeous looks, give me a break, you know?
Yeah, yeah. But this was definitely another mismatch on the card. Waterson was already 4-2. Parker was 0-1. Clearly, Waterson was the one to watch here, and again, it would show in the fight. Worth noting, Parker weighed in at 116 pounds, so she was 4 pounds over the 112-pound limit for this, but Waterson chose to take the fight anyways, and Parker got fined for being over. For the fight itself, and this was all Karate Hottie. I mean, Waterson landed a really nice right hand early on that turned Parker's head, made Parker look like kind of an amateur with her punch, because she was throwing it as she got hit, and it just threw off the trajectory of her punch and made her look really wild, and then followed up with another really hard punch. Waterson then got the fight to the mat. She got a rear naked choke in tight, and it looked like, as you're watching it, you can see, you know, as you watch enough MMA, you see people in rear naked chokes where that kind of look of realization hits their eyes, and then they start to go out. And I thought Parker might have actually been out. I mean, her eyes were open. She was not even trying to get out of the choke, but she made a move to tap just as the ref stopped it, and she kind of flopped over a bit. So I think she was out. But it was a great showcase for Waterson. She got the submission victory, and very gracious as the victor, and Parker was fine, and, you know, they hugged it out and all that stuff. But just, I mean, really nothing else to say about the fight other than just Waterson. It was all her.
Yeah, she overwhelmed her. It was very powerful, explosive, dynamic. She got the tap out. The tap reminded me a little bit of was it Misha Tate choking out Holly Holm? Holly Holm went out, I think, in that. But it was the same kind of look. Like, at the very end, it was like Holly is about to be out of it. And then I think she went out, and it was over. And I think that in this case, Parker was not out, but she could feel that she had about a half a second. And then to let go, and she rolled over, and she was dead. So,
yeah, well, not dead, thank God.
Well, no, not dead, but, you know, she was done.
So. She was done. Yeah. But definitely a great win for Waterson. And unfortunately, as with the previous fight, both these two would be one and done in Strikeforce. Parker would go on to compile a 4-5 record. She's got a couple fighters that she lost to that are still active. Tatiana Suarez, who's undefeated in the UFC. She beat Parker later in Parker's career. She had her last fight in 2014. And as our listeners probably know, Waterson is still a high-level, high-profile competitor in the UFC. And again, kind of unfortunate that she didn't get to stay, but she's also a lighter weight class. I mean, she's not somebody who would have been fighting Ronda Rousey and Misha Tate and those other fighters. So, you know, it's not like we would have seen her. And that's probably part of the reason why we didn't see her back. You know, if they were going to build, it was going to be on that higher weight class. But yeah. All right. Well, the main card is upon us. In the opening bout on the main card, Carlos Zavalos beat Andre Walker at via TKO coming away with punches at 4:49 of the first round in a light heavyweight title, or definitely not a light heavyweight title fight, in a light heavyweight bout. These were two K-1 veterans, so, you know, kickboxers. Zavalos was an ATT fighter, American Top Team, out of Miami, while Walker was fighting out of Denver. So he was the local favorite. Zavalos was also a former Golden Gloves boxer, so we expected a stand-up war. And it was, you know, that we saw it pretty much mostly on the feet.
Can I just say really quickly that Kenny Rice at the beginning of the fight noted that 36-year-old Walker and 30-year-old Zavalos only had four fights between them. And then Matt Hume says That doesn't always mean anything, because obviously Savalos has had a lot of fights outside of MMA and got a great training camp, and the skills you develop in training oftentimes are more important than the experience you get in the ring. And it just really puzzled me, because it's sort of a weird comment. Like, obviously, yeah, you need to train and you need to do all that stuff.
I missed that. I did not hear that, because that is weird.
Yeah, I mean, you can train as much as you want, but there is no substitute for a real-time cage experience. You know, you learn a lot when you lose. You learn a lot under the lights. You learn a lot making the walk and just being in there with somebody who's actually not trying to make you better, but actually trying to do physical harm to you. And so I thought that was a weird comment. I think maybe he was trying to cover for the fact that Kenny even brought that up, like, what's up with these two old guys, you know, with so few fights? So he probably shouldn't have done that at all, because it kind of points attention to the fact that they're older with, you know, it wasn't as like they had combined. Walker had 4 fights and Savalos had 0. So it was sort of a weird comment to make. So I don't know, I couldn't imagine Frank Shamrock or Ken Shamrock or any of the array of color commentators that Strikeforce has used up until this time saying that practice or you know, workout time and gym time was more important than cage time.
Yeah, it was weird overall. I mean, I have all this respect for Hume as a, you know, a trainer and an executive and all that stuff, but as a commentator, I mean, he's got the charisma of a doorknob. I mean, it just, you know, he sounded like he was reading a book, and it just was not. I mean, he had very good insights, and that's important, of course, but he had very little, for a color commentator, he had no color. So it was kind of, you know,
no emotion.
So just no emotion. I mean, it was very, very stale, or not stale, but very sterile, you know, just, and so I wasn't a fan of his commentary to begin with. And then I missed that comment. I did not hear that, but that is, you know, that's pretty bad, obviously. But I will say, for the most part, I mean, you know, he's taught, the guy knows fighting. He knows, he's done it and he's trained it. And so he, you know, that guy, you know, he needs to put his elbow over here. He needs to put his arm over here, you know, that sort of thing. So he did a lot of that. So I think he did a great job from a technical perspective, but obviously a big miss with what you just, you know, regurgitated to us. And then obviously, as I mentioned, just not Mr. Personality by any stretch.
It's called analysis, Phil. It's not regurgitation.
Whatever. For whatever reason, that was the first word that came to my mind as I was kind of spitballing there. All right. Well, again, neither fighter looked like they planned to take this fight early. Take this down early on. Nice trading on the feet. Walker landed a straight left that just seated Zavalos. I mean, it was a good left. And Zavalos was able, though, was able to recover. He weathered the storm and survived. However, Walker dropped him again and had Zavalos in serious trouble. But once again, he persevered, and now it looked like Walker had punched himself out. He looked a bit tired. He eventually went for a takedown, but Zavalos easily reversed it. Very nice reversal. Walker was on the bottom where he did not want to be. Zavalos got full mount against the cage and was raining down punches, and they didn't look like they were doing much damage. It made me think of the Joe Riggs Kazuya Misaki fight, but the ref had seen enough. He stepped in and stopped it with no protestation from Walker whatsoever.
Yeah, I like this fight. Again, you know, it wasn't super high level fight, but it was entertaining. You know, if I could just, you know, make a generalization here, and, you know, we could talk about it if you want to, but Savalos was just tough, and he hung in there. He was kind of out of it for a while. He was getting bombed. And, you know, like Hispanic fighters, you know, certainly in boxing, you know, that reputation for being super tough, you know, to take a beating, they don't quit. And like Savalos, I mean, he seemed to represent that. He's just, I mean, he gets smashed during this fight, especially after, you know, he got knocked down. And so I was sort of like rooting for him, because I'm like, can this guy survive? Can this guy do this? Can he come back? He was out on his feet. He was resilient. He kept going. And then, you know, this happens. It's the old rope-a-dope thing. Walker got tired. He kind of punched himself out. He got frustrated. The fight went to the ground. And I think it was Hume who actually said, why would he take this to the ground when every fight he's lost has been on the ground? And then all of a sudden, Savalos turns the tables. He had a lot of heart and determination. And it's crazy how when you see a fighter who's out on his feet, Savalos wasn't that bad, but he was definitely struggling. And then they get the momentum, And all of a sudden, it's this whole new adrenaline rush. And you could see Savalos having that when he was in control. One more comment. There was, you know, and it might have been Hume. I don't recall exactly. But at one point, one of the announcers said, Savalos doesn't know what zip code he's in.
I don't remember. So that has to be Kenny Rice, though, because there's some personality behind that.
So. Yeah, exactly. It had to be. And I'm like thinking, who knows what the zip code they're in? I mean, they're in Colorado, for crying out loud. Like, I don't know any zip codes outside of the one I'm in. And you're getting beat up. Like, the last thing you're thinking is, like, what zip code? I mean, isn't the phrase, you don't know what city he's in? Or yeah, something like that? Like, zip?
Yeah.
I mean, you know what zip code you're in? Do you know
I any do. Zip code? I do. And it's a funny, very quick, funny story. I went to Walgreens today, and the lady at the thing was putting my information in for a, you know, whatever, one of the rewards cards or whatever. And she's like, zip code. And I live in a small town. We only have one zip code. I was like, well, I live here. She's like, oh, and she blanked. And I'm like, well, there's really only one option. And and I said it to her. So she didn't know what zip code we were in. So to be fair, it does happen, I guess.
I just think if you're getting your ass kicked, right, the things you forget, like zip codes, not at the top of the list of example.
So again, as you're getting punched in the face on the mat, you're like, 95327. 953. I'm still okay because I still know what zip code I'm in. Yeah.
Exactly. You know, I don't think they ask that question either. You know, when the doctor's talking to you.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's what day is it? Who's the president? You know, right. What zip code is it? Or what zip code are you in? That could be one of them. So, yeah. But. You mentioned Savalos coming back. We will see that in another fight on this card in just a couple minutes. In fact, it's actually going to be our next fight, so we'll talk about that in just a second. But as was the theme on this card, neither fighter would appear in Strikeforce again. Savalos would fight several more times, ending up at 3-4, last competing in 2016. Walker would fight one more time, losing in 2009 to end his MMA career with a 1-5 record. All right, our next bout, 155 pounds. Billy Evangelista defeated Luke Quadillo via unanimous decision in what I would term to be the fight of the night. Evangelista undefeated at 7-0 coming into this one, including 5-0 in Strikeforce. Quadillo was 15-12, and this would be his Strikeforce debut. Obviously very experienced with two fights in the UFC, but Quadillo was on a three-fight losing streak coming in. Did want to mention in his pre-fight interview, Billy said he was shooting for a KO, but a submission would be great as he had not gotten one of those yet. Neither of those would happen in this fight. But let's jump into it. I did want to ask Josh, did you notice the very awkward pause when the ref asked the fighters if they had any questions? I mean, they both clearly shook their heads no, and then the ref literally stood there, and I timed it because it was just so weird, for 4 seconds, which doesn't sound very long, but when you're, you know, you've seen 1,000 fights and they always say, you have any questions for the blue corner, any questions for the red corner, all right, touch gloves, come out fighting. And instead, he, you know, asks the questions and then waits. 1, 2. Like, it was so awkward and doing nothing. I mean, what was he trying to extend the stare down for, you know, dramatic effect? It was so awkward. Did you catch that?
You know, I didn't pick up on that. Obviously on UFC Fight Pass, you can, skip ahead, skip forward, you know, and I probably just was like, you know, skipped over that part of it and straight to the actual fight. But that's awkward. I don't know. Maybe he froze. He got a little weird underneath the lights, or maybe he thought somebody was supposed to ask something. I don't know.
I actually think I solved it later on because I noticed that the refs, what they would do is they would look off to the side. I think they were waiting to get like a nod from like one of the judges or somebody from the commission that's like, all right, let's get started. But it was really weird. And the poor fighters are like, like, all right, I just gave this guy like my murder, death, kill look, you know, to the guy standing across from me. And now I, you know, we're both like feeling awkward. So anyways,
that's first time a referee's tried to ice a fighter.
Yeah. I mean, that's what it kind of felt like. And I didn't know any of the refs. They all were probably local guys, but it's just very awkward. But man, what a start to this one though. Quadillo catches Evangelista with a stiff left jab early on and hurts him. I mean, and Evangelista was rocked. He gets dropped again. I thought the ref might actually stop it. I'm glad he didn't, because I don't think he was truly, I mean, he was in trouble, but it wasn't time for the fight to be stopped. And Quadillo just kept catching him. But to Evangelista's credit, kind of what you were talking about in the last fight, he held on and persevered and was able to clear the cobwebs enough to clinch, and then he threw some punches of his own, and something got lit inside Evangelista, and he finished the round strong and even dropped Caudillo towards the end of the round. And I think, as with Walker in the previous fight, I think Caudillo just maybe perhaps had expended too much energy. And the rest of the fight, it really settled down, and it consisted of Evangelista really picking a Caudillo apart on the feet, never really in danger. In the third round, Evangelista got one of the nicest takedowns that I've seen in a while. Very nice double leg takedown where he picked him up, double legged him, and like pushed him into the cage. Like, it was really pretty stout. I really liked it. But Caudillo, just after that initial flurry, he just didn't have an answer for anything. And so it was a pretty easy decision for the judges. I mean, I knew obviously what had happened when I started the fight, and, you know, knowing that it was a decision, I'm thinking, well, that's a decision for the wrong guy, because this guy Caudillo just like almost tore his head off. But yeah, it was definitely, I think it was a very good test for Evangelista to get hurt like that and be able to come back and then, you know, get a very solid decision win.
Yeah, this was a very entertaining fight. I have to say first, since I'm a judger of the Trunks, commentator.
Is that your co-host and co-host and Trunks judger?
Trunks, yes, Trunks. Evangelista had like some wacky trunks. They were like Ultimate Warrior like tassels. It looked, you remind me of, it's kind of like, you know, see, Jorge Maromero Paez, like the kind of trunks he used to wear in boxing, like that would just be really flashy. And I found him a little bit distracting, and I think that I'm glad.
Clearly, you were distracted by them.
I mean, didn't you notice these? These are not MMA trunks.
I noticed them, but I see, my favorite color is orange, and that's what Caudillo's trunks were. And I loved Caudillo's. Like, I was like, those, I was thinking, man, those would be the type I would wear. So I was kind of more paying attention to those, but yeah.
Okay. Well, anyway, I think when they're just like flapping out there, they're sort of inappropriate for an MMA fight just because of the nature of MMA and, you know, all the closeness, you know, a little bit different than boxing. But
Before you move on, let me ask. So if you, because I agree with you to an extent. I don't like, so what type of trunks, if you were a fighter, what type of trunks would you want to wear? And I'll tell you, like, I like Shogun's trunks are always too tight and too short, and he doesn't have like this great body, so it's like it does not look good on Shogun Hua, and I don't like those. I would not wear those anyways, but I could see feeling like you're just a little more like tighter, a little more put together. Like, I could see that. So I would probably go with like, I like the old style, like longer, like board short types. Yeah. Those are like what I liked, but I also at the same time might feel a little bit more restricted. So I'd probably go a little bit shorter and but, you know, definitely not super tight. But what would be your choice?
I'd definitely go Brock Lesnar type, you
okay.
know.
Okay. All right. That's
just a little bit longer, you know, that kind of thing. Nothing too short, nothing where Dana White wants to fire me. And, it's just too dangerous too. Yeah. So I don't know. It's just interesting. I mean, I don't mind it, you know, you see it in pro wrestling, that kind of stuff, but it's just what happens if somebody starts pulling on that, grabbing on it, it could be a distraction. But as far as the fight goes, you know, Evangelista was just explosive. He was busy. He was, after the first round, he's just so wanting to win in a way that matters, you know. And I think Caudillo just sort of burned himself out, which you tend to see with these, you know, five minute rounds. You know, it's just like, that's a long time. And especially when you're trying to knock somebody out and you're going all out, and then what have you got left after that? So I thought it was good because Evangelista was just excited. He landed more. He was more confident. He took control and he dominated, you know, the rest of the fight. So it was definitely the most entertaining.
It was. Yeah, I think it was the fight of the night. For sure. But Evangelista would be back in Strikeforce the following year, so we'll discuss him more then. Caudillo would be one and done in Strikeforce. He'd fight a handful of times after this, ending his career in 2012 at 17-17. All right, next bout, 170 pounds. Donnie Lyles defeated Pete Spratt via submission, coming by way of rear naked choke at 159 of the third round. Lyles was an interesting prospect. He was 11-5. He'd fought some named guys, including Jay Heron and Chris Camozzi. He'd beaten Seth Baczynski in his last fight, so he was primed for something big here. Spratt, for his part, was 18-15. He had been fighting professionally since 1999. A grizzled multi-time UFC vet, Spratt had fought some of the best, including Carlos Newton, Robbie Lawler, and I'll stop right there real quick. This is going way back. But do you remember the Pete Spratt Robbie Lawler fight by chance? Do you? It was a pretty unique fight the way that it went. Do you remember that?
I've never seen that fight. No,
you should check it out. Spratt threw some nasty, nasty leg kicks to Lawler and really hurt him pretty bad. It's a pretty interesting looking fight.
He didn't beat Lawler though.
Yes, he did. I want to say he beat him via injury from the leg kicks, if I remember correctly. So I'll.
This was like early Lawler before he.
This is like is like 2002 or something like that. So I'm actually quickly looking it up as we're talking. So it was 2003. Yeah, hip injury. Yeah, he beat him in the second round, 228 in the second round, April 25th, 2003, UFC 42, submission via hip injury. He was leg kicking him to the inside thighs so much, and Lawler's like legs were like going out, and he hurt him with that. Like I can't think. I'm sure it's happened, but I can't think off the top of my head of another time where a guy was getting kicked on the inside thighs and was getting, you know, hurt to the point where they ended up having to submit because they were just too injured from those kicks. I mean, obviously we've seen guys get chopped down with leg kicks, but where he was getting kicked to the point where he ended up submitting, you know, because of a hip injury, that's pretty crazy. So,
I'm stunned. I gotta go watch that because based off of this performance, I'm really surprised.
Yeah, well, you know, this was 2008. This was 5 years later, and Spratt had been fighting for, you know, 4 years at that point. He was, you know, on the, you know, more the other end of his career, even though he fought for a number of years after this. But he'd also fought Chris Lights Out Lytle. He'd fought GSP at one point. He'd also made it onto The Ultimate Fighter Season 4, which was, I think that was the comeback, and they had a bunch of guys that had been part of like some of the earlier UFCs. But Spratt's thing, his Achilles heel had always been his submission defense. And that was something that always hurt him as a fighter. You know, we'd see if that would come into play here. It was a decent fight. Clearly, you know, pretty clear early on that Lyles was a more well-rounded fighter, which was not, a big surprise with Pete Spratt. But he landed some good takedowns, got some good strikes in. Spratt had a few good moments, but Lyles was just too much, and he got the rear naked choke submission in the third, although, to be honest, it looked more like a chin crank. But a nice notch on the belt of Donnie Lyles. He said afterwards this was the biggest win of his career, and it was . I don't think he had any bigger names on his record than, as far as wins go, than Pete Spratt. So it was a nice fight. Nothing that, you know, to write home about, but I thought it was pretty decent. What did you think?
Again, I thought it was entertaining. Lyles was busier. He was more active. He had a game plan. And this was the kind of fight where you could see that he had prepared in a way that allowed him to be successful. Like, he wasn't in there just sort of trying to do one thing. Like, he knew that he had a strategy, and he just was relentless. And, you know, he had the stand-up. He had the takedowns. He just kind of outclassed him. And once he got him into a position for a submission, it didn't come easy. It wasn't like a quick thing. Like, he worked at it for much of the round. And I think that shows a certain amount of confidence and ability to get into position. He just kept pushing and pushing and pushing, and then he got it, and it was over. I think that, you know, in this case, it was one-sided, but Spratt did not have the same sort of energy. Like, he looked a little bit lethargic to me. Like, I don't know. Some guys and girls you watch fight, and you sort of like can tell that they're doing the fight because they have to fight, but they'd much rather be somewhere else. And then some guys you're like, wow, this person is born to fight. And I just sort of felt like Spratt was not in it in this fight at all. He was not at the same sort of level and intensity. You know, Conor McGregor is one of those guys. Like, when he's fighting, you know, like, this guy would fight for free. He's a fighter.
He would not fight for free, but I get your point, though.
Not now. Not now, yes. But, I mean, he clearly enjoys what he's doing. So, I don't know, did you get any sense with that Spratt seemed just kind of like not all there for this?
Yeah, I think that's fair. He didn't seem to be super into the fight. I mean, I haven't seen enough of his fights to know if that's just kind of his, you know, his baseline or anything like that. But, yeah, he definitely didn't jump out as somebody that was like, oh, man, this guy's in it. And, you know, Lyles was, like I said, the better fighter. But, yeah.
There's no Josh Thompson.
No, for sure. He wasn't smiling and, you know, happy to be there and super explosive or anything like that. So I think that's fair. But once again, neither fighter would be back in Strikeforce. Lyles would continue fighting until 2015, ended up with a 17-7 record, so a very respectable record. Spratt continued fighting until the age of 46, losing in 2017 to end his MMA career at 25-24, which, I, again, would drive me crazy. Can I just do one more fight, even if I lose it? At least I got my 50th pro fight, 25-25. I'd do it for free just so I could get that number, because that's kind of my, you know, my OCD there.
But you retire with a winning record.
I know. Forever. Yeah. That's the other side of it. So, yeah.
How about the guy before us who was 17-17 when he retired?
Yeah. Which I was like, I'm okay with that. Cause you know, you're not at 50, you know, so like, or, you know, real close to that. And you're an even Steven. So I'm okay with that. I'm all right with that. I'm more okay with 17-17 than I am with 25-24.
Are you a neat freak? Is your car clean?
Well, no. I have a 5-year-old and an almost 4-year-old. I cleaned it this week because someone else is going to be driving it for a little bit for no important reason. So I cleaned it for that. But you should have seen it before that. So no, I'm not. But I do not go to bed happy if our house is like a mess. So it bothers me. But I'm not as, you know, I'm not as diligent about it as I would be if I didn't have a 5-year-old and then almost.
Just with your fight records.
Okay. Yes, just with my fight records. All right, the co-main event is upon us. 185-pound fight between Frank Trigg. He defeated Valeriko Vitali via unanimous decision. Trigg, 38 years old here. He'd won 4 of his last 5, which included victories over Mayhem Miller, Kazuo Misaki, and Edwin Deweese. So he was on the upswing even if his career was winding down. Still, Trigg was pretty open about he knew he only had a certain amount of fights left. He had recently moved his training to Extreme Couture, was now being coached by Randy Couture, although Randy was not in his corner that night. Trigg had also fought only 5 weeks earlier in Japan and had a 1-month-old son at this point. So he was, his preparation was nowhere near what he would have liked it to have been. I'm sure, and he talked about that a little bit in pre-fight interviews. Vitali was also doing well in his career. He had been victorious in 5 of his last 6 fights. That only loss was in a very controversial decision against Trevor Prangley at Strikeforce before Menander One Man Survives, during which Vitali had been accidentally poked in the eye and was unable to continue. And we talked about that fight with Trevor during our last episode, and he kind of intimated that he thought maybe Vitali was trying to buy himself a little bit of time. So we talked about that a little bit, but regardless, Vitali was unable to continue and they stopped the fight. Despite that, you know, he was on a bit of a roll. So this was two very grizzled veterans that were going to be, you know, meeting up for, and let's see who's going to win. But Josh the Punk Thompson joined the commentary team for this one. You know, I thought Trigg looked really good in this fight. I mean, Nico offered very little. He let Trigg dictate the pace. He landed shots he wanted to in the first couple of rounds. In fact, kind of reminded me of a Diaz brothers fight where the punches don't look all that great. Like they're not like fast or loaded up, but they're accurate and they add up. And he was, you know, Trigg was throwing some pretty good elbow shots, and Nico just, I don't know what he was doing, but he was just taking them and eating them. And it was kind of weird. And then speaking of weird, there was a very weird moment in the second round where they brought in Ron Kruk, who was interviewing Trigg cornerman Ron Frazier, and his response went out over the loudspeakers like in the arena instead of on commentary. So even like the fighters could hear what he was saying. It was very weird, and I would have been actually probably would have been kind of mad because that you know, he might have been discussing, he was kind of discussing the you know, the strategy there, and you know, that would have been distracting at the very least. But in the third, Trigg got a very nice dump takedown early on, and in the end, it was a vintage Trigg fight. I mean, not the greatest stand-up, and even said in this post-fight, it wasn't the greatest stand-up, but really great takedowns and just overall grit and pressure. And the crowd, they didn't love the fight. They even booed at the final bell, but it was a good strategic game plan, and Vitali just had no answer for it.
So what's the deal with Frank Trigg? Like, this guy looks like, you know, exactly like Kurt Angle. I mean, like, instead of Jason Jordan, they should have went and found Frank Trigg and made him Kurt Angle's fake son. I mean, can you believe this guy?
Well, like, they're about the same age. Well, actually, I think Trigg's older than Kurt, so I don't think that would have worked. But I get what you're saying. I could see a resemblance there.
They had twin brothers act like they had surgery so they could look like each other. I'm sure they could have figured out a way to make Frank Trigg Kurt Angle's son.
Which, by the way, besides being, you know, great amateur wrestlers and all this stuff, do you know what Frank Trigg and Kurt Angle have in common?
They're both bald with blue eyes.
Well, besides that.
What? No.
They both wrestled in TNA.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Frank Trigg had a, I want to say it was AJ Styles. He had a worked, like a work shoot, like old school, you know, UWFI Pancrase like style wrestling match. But that the crowd just dumped all over. I mean, it was awful. Like he was trying to work, you know, like in the way that Brock can work, you know, an a wrestling match and like incorporate MMA in an entertaining manner without it, you know, dragging or anything like that. Trigg did like the opposite. Like it did not work at all. Like it was really bad, and they never tried it again. Thank God. But yeah, they both wrestled for TNA. So
it's probably the only time AJ Styles ever been booed for real, you know.
Well, they weren't booing him. It wasn't his fault. It was not his fault.
I really like Trigg's offense early. Lots of really good short elbows, and there's just something about those, you know, like it, not a lot of fighters do it enough, and it's very effective. And so I like that. And he had some really good Ben Askren like takedowns in this fight, just like really solid wrestling takedowns. So it was an entertaining fight. You know, it was a good show, and you know, it wasn't like the fight of the night by any means. But there was something good about I think every match on this card. So
yeah.
I
feel like this was for the strategy people, the purist, you know, like this was a true MMA fight, and there was great strategy, and it showed like all different aspects of Trigg's game. And, you know, I thought it was a good fight. I definitely didn't think it was worth booing, but you know, they were looking for someone to die. I don't know. But, Trigg would fight this one time in Strikeforce, as we mentioned earlier, and this would actually be Vitaly's last fight inside the Hexagon as well. Trigg would get one more run in the UFC after this, losing to Josh Koscheck and Matt Serra. He ended his MMA career in 2011 with a 21-9 record. He's gone on to do commentary. He's been a referee, and he does movie stunt work as well, and he has agreed to appear on the show in the future, likely in January 2021. We're just working on when that will be, but Trigg will always go down for his feud with Matt Serra. I mean, he'll always go down in history for that. I mean, that was, you know, he got into the Hall of Fame, I believe, based on that. And I, you know, or Matt Hughes, did I say Matt Serra? I meant Matt Hughes. Those two fights were, I mean, I don't know that I've ever heard a louder crowd reaction than I believe in their first fight when Trigg got the rear naked choke on Hughes, and Hughes picked him up and carried him across the cage. Uh-huh. If you want to hear like a true like pro wrestling pop in an MMA event, go back and watch that, because I mean that crowd exploded when Hughes did that. And you know, Trigg, it's no surprise he ended up doing some pro wrestling, because he knew how to sell a fight. He was the heel. He knew he was the heel. He knew Matt Hughes was the babyface, and he sold the fight appropriately. And so, you know, Trigg's one of the best talkers and personalities in MMA. He was doing commentary in the radio show, the tag radio show with George Garcia, you know, back in the day. Like he's an all around guy. He's an all around star. And so, you know, Good stuff for him, and I'm looking forward to talking with him. Vitaly would fight a handful more times, and I actually worked with X1, a Hawaiian promotion that he would compete for multiple times, so got to work with him a little bit, and he retired in 2014 with a 30-11 record. All right, it's main event time. In the main event at catchweight, 165 pounds, Dwayne Bang Ludwig defeated Sammy Morgan via TKO, coming by way of punches at 201 of the first round. Ludwig was coming off a doctor stoppage loss to Takanori Gomi in Japan, in which his nose had been broken and he was bleeding badly. I actually went back and watched that fight because I saw, just doing my research, I was like, doctor stoppage at 228 of the first round. Man, what happened? And Gomi just landed this like left, just blasted him. And I could see him letting the fight go, but Ludwig was bleeding pretty profusely. It was pretty nasty. And but he was looking to right the ship against Morgan, who had beaten him 3 years prior in front of a Denver crowd. And Morgan, for his part, was coming off three straight losses to Kung Lee, Paul Daly, and Fabricio Camoz. So, you know, pretty murderer's row there. Pretty tough stretch.
No shame there. No shame losing to those guys.
None whatsoever, for sure. But regarding this being a rematch, Ludwig said that he really respected Sammy, that in their previous fight, Morgan had come to fight and he hadn't, he'd kind of overlooked him. But he said for this one, his head was going to be more in it and he was ready. And it definitely was. For the fight itself, obviously being a Colorado native, Ludwig was a huge favorite, of course. And we saw the Punk back on commentary for this one, but he would not be on for very long. Early takedown for Morgan. He held it for a bit, but Ludwig was able to stand back up, and once there he landed a very nice liver shot with a left hook and a nod to his original MMA trainer, Boss Rutten, then followed up with a punch and then strikes on the ground that had Morgan tapping, and revenge had been secured, and the Colorado crowd exploded, happy that they got to go home with the win from their hometown hero. And it's worth noting that Banks showed Sammy a ton of respect after the fight on the mic to the crowd, telling them to give Sammy respect, credit him for giving a rematch when he didn't have to. But very, very good finish. I wish it was a little more. I mean, you can't get much more decisive than your opponent tapping out because he's being punched. But it wasn't like a clean knockout where you're like, oh yeah, that's it. But that left hand to the body was pretty awesome. I really liked it. But Josh, what did you think of the main event?
Well, I want to say that as much as I love Josh Thompson as a fighter, he's no Dominic Cruz. I was not impressed, since we're talking about the commentary, about his, the times he was on the mic at all. It's just weird how that is when you have a charismatic fighter and then a guy that gets boring when you put him at a desk. This fight was crazy because it was the liver shot that ended it. It was a delayed reaction. Like you couldn't even see it in real time, like, because it was the shot that the punch was thrown and the camera's on his back, and so you just kind of see his back like quiver, right? And you just sort of see like his just like his skin and his body just like shake, and then he goes down. The head moves, the body doesn't. And so so many fighters, they want to go for the knockout. I mean, if you could knock somebody out or hit him in the right spot in the body relentlessly over and over, we've talked about this. We've seen a few knockouts like this. It's going to be devastating. And it's basically over than that, because when he tapped out, like, you don't see a guy tap out from strikes very often. He's tapping out not really because he's getting hit in the face, because as you said, those punches were not, like, devastating when he's getting punched in the ground and pound. He tapped out because he's still feeling that body shot, and the liver shot's a delayed reaction. It's you feel it, or you get hit with it, and you know it's coming. It's like an earthquake after you sort of like feel the shaking, like you know it's coming, and it lingers, and that's why he tapped out. So you feel kind of bad for that, but it was, again, impressive win for Ludwig for sure.
Yeah, I agree with everything you just said. Definitely just a great moment for Bang, and just a great win for him for sure. But after this big win, Bang would have a very quick turnaround. He would be back in the inside the hexagon the next month at Strikeforce Destruction against fellow UFC vet Eve Edwards. I'm looking forward to talking about that. This was it for Morgan in both Strikeforce and MMA overall. I was surprised to realize after I was doing the research that he retired after this. Ended up on a 4-fight losing streak with a record of 19-12. But that's it for for this show. I mean, Payback is in the books. No fighters pop for drugs of abuse or performance enhancers after this event. But that might have been because there were no drug tests administered. According to an MMA Weekly story, the local athletic commission said they administered tests randomly and for whatever reason chose not to do any tests for this one, which is really weird to me. So nobody tested positive because nobody tested. Maybe they wouldn't have tested positive anyways. But yeah, kind of weird. Total disclosed fire payroll, $101,251. Dwayne Ludwig made $30,000, which included a $15,000 win bonus, while Sammy Morgan made a total of $10,000. Frank Trigg officially made $1 with no win bonus. But the article said he was likely paid on a separate contract. Vitaly got $20,000. Donnie Lyles got $5,000, as did Pete Spratt. And then Michelle Waterson took home a cool $3,000. Overall, entertaining card. But once again, it felt like a one-off. You got a few faces that have appeared in Strikeforce before, like Dwayne, Sammy, and Nico. But two of those would never appear in the promotion again. So, I mean, who are we building with these kind of one-off fights, these one-off events? I mean, it just seemed really inconsequential to me, even though it was entertaining. So, Josh, what did you think?
Wow, that payout is ridiculous. I mean, that's not a lot of money at all for Ludwig. I mean, you get the win bonus, but I mean, Michelle Waterson getting $3,000. I wonder if all the money went to Frank Trigg, since it's undisclosed, and he got the $1 on paper, and who knows how much they agreed to. But That's one of the lowest payrolls I've seen, you know, 101 grand. So anyway, it's that's what it was at the time. They got 3,000 people into the building, and it was what it was. But I liked the card. I thought most of the fights were entertaining. They weren't really high-level fights, but they were fights that were, from a fan's perspective, there was something to like about everyone, you know, everybody's performance, at least one of them. So I thought it was good, solid card, not really groundbreaking, but it was entertaining. It just felt like a card I'm flipping around and, you know, I see it, you know, it felt like an Access sort of TV MMA card, you know, like, what is this? Oh, MMA, I'm going to check it out. That's kind of cool. It did not feel like Strikeforce at all. In fact, very little was Strikeforce, except for, you know, Josh Thompson. It did not feel like the Showtime or the CBS kind of broadcast. So I'd say it was kind of a pause, so to speak, in the history of Strikeforce. It's just, it was there. Decent card. No real long-term impact in the MMA world. But any card without Bob Sapp, okay, it's they're still doing better than they did, you know, a year.
By the way, Matt Hume trained Bob Sapp. So just another reason to... Yeah. No, well, I agree.
Well, then Bob Sapp, he needs a refund.
Yeah. Well, it was, I agree with your assessment. It was, you know, overall entertaining, but just kind of, like you said, kind of a pause, you know, just a kind of another MMA event. But in our next episode, we're still going to be, we're still a little bit up in the air on who our fighter interview will be. But stay tuned to our social media for an announcement on that. You can follow us on Twitter and on Instagram at the Hexagon Pod. So you can check us out on there. You can also reach me at phil@insidethehexagon.com. Would love to hear from you, get your feedback. After that, we are going to be covering Strikeforce Destruction. So we're going to get back to a little bit more of a Strikeforce feel, long awaited light heavyweight title fight between champion Bobby Southworth and Renato Babalu Sobral. Quick return for Dwayne Bang Ludwig, as we just mentioned. The Strikeforce debut of Hands of Steel Scott Smith in a very memorable fight. Looking forward to that. Joe Riggs, Luke Stewart, they're all back. And then Josh's twin, Luke Rockhold, is going to make his Strikeforce big card debut. He had fought for Strikeforce before, but he was going to make his you know, on a major event, he was going to fight on there for the first time. So I can't wait to cover that one. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah, well, you know, for the record, I, you know, I have to be honest about this. I don't look quite as good on a white horse as Luke Rockhold does if you follow his Instagram. So that's about the only edge I'm going to give him in that regard.
All right. And then the episode after that, we are going to have the man himself, Babalu Sobral, on the show. I'm really looking forward to that. I've actually already spoken with him. It's a very intriguing, very open and honest discussion. So I'm looking forward to that. But with that, we're going to go ahead and ride off into the sunset. Hope that you stay safe and you stay healthy. We'll see you soon.
Have you ever wanted to know how to win a Formula One Grand Prix? I mean, really know. Know about the driver tactics from the cockpit, the strategy calls from the pit wall, and even the mind games in the paddock. There's a lot more that goes into winning a Grand Prix than just 90 minutes of racing. So every week on the F1 Strategy Report, we're taking a deep dive into the decisions that shape every result. Hey there, my name is Michael Laminato, and every week I'm joined by an expert guest from the paddock to talk through the big calls that won the race and the missteps that resulted in bitter defeat. Before every race, we'll look back at the previous year's result and consult the current form guide, and we'll be in your feed after every Grand Prix dissecting the outcome and what it means for the championship. So for your regular hit of Formula One analysis, subscribe to the F1 Strategy Report wherever you get your favourite podcasts. The Strategy Report is a Beer Mogul podcast on the Evergreen Podcasts Network. My name's Michael Laminato, and I'll catch you after the checkered flag.